This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, your pop culture home.
Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at audibletrial.com/thekingsofsport. Audible.com has over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. To start your trial today, go to audibletrial.com/thekingsofsport.
Welcome to the Kings of Sport, the podcast that's changing the game one show at a time, with your hosts, Alfred Cottaway, Nate Milton, and Marcus Vanderberg. So sit back and relax, because you're now down with the Kings.
And welcome to the Kings of Sport, the podcast that's changing the game one show at a time, a.k.a. the world's most dangerous sports show, a.k.a. iTunes' longest-running weekly episodic sports program hosted and produced by two or more African-Americans not affiliated with the major network. I am the Godfather, Nate Milton, joined as always by Big Nasty Alfred Cunningham and Marcus Vanderberg. What's going on, fellas?
What is going on, Nate?
We're back.
Yes, we are back. Sorry, our bad for last week. We had a great show, folks, and you know we can't recapture the magic, but I will just say this might have been the greatest show in Kings of Sport history. It featured Marcus coming to us live via satellite from the Popeye's Chicken parking lot in the Bronx. It featured Alfred and I singing songs and telling funny stories and.
It also, crack.
Yes, it featured the return of Cracky Tales, and I think that's what happened to the show, Marcus. Like, I think crack giveth and crack taketh away, because we were having so much fun telling Cracky Tales, and, you know, we talked about DMX and talked more about Rob Ford, but then, like, right when we were ending the show, I remember that it was the anniversary of Eddie Guerrero's passing.
Mm.
Yeah.
Speaking of crack.
Right, so yeah, the mood wow. changed a little bit, and we got a little bit somber. So I think that's the Skype guys decided not to allow us to publish that show because you know, in honor of Eddie Guerrero. So
that show's in a better place now. It's resting with Eddie. R.I.P.
I thought you were gonna be like Randy Orton in that terrible, terrible angle.
No. Quite the opposite.
That show was down there.
Just like Eddie.
Yeah, one of the worst angles in the history of the WWE. And that's saying something. Shout out to Katie Vick. But this is going to be a fun show. We got a lot to talk about. We have some ratchetness in segment four, as always. We've got a rousing edition of the Ringside Wrap today. And we've got some really interesting topics to kick things off here in the A block. And who would have thought, guys, in the middle of November, baseball would lead off the show. Not only did we have a big trade a few hours ago, but our boy A-Rod, or your boy A-Rod, he ain't my boy Alfred. A-Rod.
Stay up, A-Rod.
Yeah, A-Rod did his best Tony Montana impression at his hearing, and he was like, come on, this the last time you're going to see a bad guy like this again. Say goodnight to the bad guy, Holmes. Make way for the bad guy. There's a bad guy coming through. And apparently he's slamming stuff and yelling at people and just making a big scene. But the crazy thing is he might not be 100% wrong. So, Marcus, for anybody that did not hear what went on with Alex Rodriguez today, let the people know what's up.
Yeah, so Wednesday morning, A-Rod had his much-anticipated hearing, his grievance hearing. So he had the suspension that was handed down by Major League Baseball during the season for 211 games, I believe. He appealed it, and as part of the appeal process, he had to take part in this grievance hearing with Major League Baseball and an arbitrator. So when it came time to get the meeting started and everything, A-Rod was told that A-Rod's attorneys would not be able to question Commissioner Bud Selig as part of the arbitration hearing, and A-Rod, rightfully so, said, you know, this is fucking bullshit, and stormed out. I don't blame A-Rod. I don't see how it's fair that A-Rod can be grilled, but the man responsible for the suspension itself cannot beat Road in return. So A-Rod stormed out, and a few hours later, he appeared on WFAN in New York with Mike Francesa, and he did a live in-studio interview with Francesa where he, you know, ripped into Bud Selig and sort of explained his side of the story. And he said, you know, Bud Selig hates his Dutch, which is probably true. So you should go back and actually watch the interview. It's pretty interesting to see A-Rod be that honest and that upfront. You know, whether you believe it or not, it's another story. But, you know, the guy had a point to be upset, and I'm on A-Rod's side on this. I don't understand how an arbitrator would allow not to, you know, get Selig in the midst there.
Obviously, I don't have to say it. I'm definitely on A-Rod's side, not because of any type of allegiance to the New York Yankees, but because it feels like the fix is in. Here's what I'm worried about, though. I feel like A-Rod knows that the fix is in, and he knows that now MLB is coming down on him, and it feels like he thinks he's helpless. I feel like he's losing his composure. It reminds me of the line from Jay-Z where he says, the Nets can go 0 for 82, and I look at you like this shit's gravy. In essence, he's saying that no matter what happens, I'm still balling. Everything is still all good. But I feel like A-Rod knows that now he and his career is in jeopardy, and he doesn't think he can do anything about it. So now he's going on these radio shows, and he's not keeping his composure like he knows everything's going to be okay. I think, like, A-Rod feels like this is going to be the end of him. He's even said that the Bud Selig is trying to destroy him, and it's personal. So this type of language from A-Rod is very unsettling for those of you who are out there left who are A-Rod fans.
Yeah, and I think that this is, I'm not sure. Like, I'm not sure if this was genuine. I'm sure he was genuinely upset, like Marcus said, that Selig didn't show up. But, I mean.
Oh, no, he showed up, but basically he didn't have to be under oath, so.
Yeah, that's what I mean. He didn't have to testify. But, I mean, Selig never testifies, if I'm not mistaken. Like, this isn't the first time that he's been hearing.
No, MLB commissioner has ever testified.
Yeah, you know, so this is not anything out of the ordinary from Bud's side of the ledger, but I do think that, you know, A-Rod, that his upset and his disgust at that was genuine, but I also think that he's waging a PR war. You know, this is not a legal battle in the sense that it's a court system in the U.S. court of laws. This is a baseball deal, and a lot of the public don't understand the rules and regulations of Major League Baseball, whether they are written or unwritten. And I think A-Rod is thinking, you know, he's a guy that is very image conscious. He's very savvy when it comes to the media, regardless of what you think about him. And I think that he's like, you know what, if I can engender support on my side, regardless of how people feel about me, you know, this is a feat. A-Rod is one of the most hated athletes out there, but he's got people sympathizing with him over this matter. And I think that, you know, he's not going to get everything overturned, but I would not be surprised if the actual ruling, you know, is A-Rod is suspended, you know, let's say 70 to 95 games, somewhere in that range, Marcus.
Yeah, I'm sure there's probably another level A-Rod can take this, like an appeals level for, you know, a First Circuit court judge or something of that matter. You know, the only thing keeping New Yorkers from really supporting A-Rod and Yankee fans in general is that contract. You know, I think Yankee fans want that contract off the books. I think otherwise, I think Yankee fans would have his back here because I do think he's being targeted. But, you know, when he's getting paid that much money and there's the possibility that if he retires or walks away, that's wiped off the books. You know, I understand why Yankee fans aren't going to support him. So in terms of the suspension life, it wouldn't bother me if he got knocked down to something like a 50 game or 65, whatever Ryan Braun served. You know, I understand why they slapped a 211 game suspension based on the facts they had, and they thought he was tampering with the investigation. But at this point, it's not good for baseball, and it's not good for A-Rod's future.
I don't really think New York Yankee fans or the New York media or New York general public would have A-Rod's back if there were different situations like you were talking about, Marcus, because I don't think New York has ever embraced A-Rod. There's nothing about him that screams New York. They love their own. So even if you win in New York, you kind of have to be that type of passionate person, that high-energy guy who wears his heart on his sleeve. And A-Rod's never been that guy. He's always been kind of aloof. He hangs out in Miami. He dates models. He's very rich. He's that guy that you love to hate. And even when I look on Twitter, the people who do sympathize with A-Rod say so in kind of a tongue-in-cheek manner, like, you know what, I kind of finally feel sorry for this narcissistic guy a little bit. And I just don't see a lot of sympathy for him. So I just think this is one of those things where people are looking at it like it couldn't have happened to a nicer guy. And even though A-Rod does have a point and people should be siding with him, I feel like people are very apprehensive towards siding with A-Rod.
Yeah, and I think this is the test case even more so than somebody with the personality of a Roger Clemens or Barry Bonds, because A-Rod has been so polarizing and he has stirred up so many negative feelings amongst fans. You know, I'm kind of like those people that you talk about on Twitter, Alfred. You know, it's like, this has to be so egregious for Major League Baseball because it has made me sympathize with A-Rod, and I'm somebody who has never liked this dude, you know, and I'm somebody who has gone on record saying, if you're a grown-ass man, you should not have more than one painting commissioned of yourself as a mythological creature. I mean, you know, I got a picture of myself in the living room as a Kraken, but I can't go and get two of them because that's just egregious. And so for my man A-Rod with the two centaur pictures of himself, you know, for me, as a Braves fan who hates the Yankees anyway, and as a sports fan that dislikes A-Rod and what he apparently stands for with his public persona, for Major League Baseball to make me feel some sort of sympathy for this dude means Major League Baseball has an issue. And I think, like Marcus said, the quicker they can get this thing handled and dealt with, and A-Rod can, you know, serve his 50, 60, 80 games, however many it is, you know, I think it would be the best thing for the sport.
Hopefully this is resolved soon. I don't know how long this is going to drag out, or, you know, eventually if they'll settle or what, but it seems like A-Rod won't be back for any more of the hearings at this point.
Yeah, no, especially when you're, you know, flipping over tables and stuff. You know, you can't flip over a table and then come back in. Be like, okay, what we going to talk about now? Like, forget this, bud. Forget this, bud. I ain't talking to you no more. Stomp, stomp, stomp. 5 minutes later. So where were we, guys? You can't. When you storm out, you got to storm out. So
my temper got the best of me.
Yeah, exactly. Let's go from a guy that is on the way out to two guys that are on their way into new clubhouses. A big trade went down. You know, a rare blockbuster trade in Major League Baseball, Marcus, and it involves two perennial American League contenders.
Yeah, this trade came out of nowhere this evening. The Texas Rangers are trading Ian Kinsler to the Detroit Tigers for Prince Fielder. Prince Fielder was, in terms of popularity, was on the short side of the stick after his performance in the playoffs, where he didn't have the power this year at all. And he has that massive contract that the Tigers signed him. 2 years ago, they signed him to this big deal. And Texas, in return, opens up a spot for their prospect Jurickson Profar to play second base. They now get a first baseman to replace Mitch Moreland, who struggled at the end of last season. And they're getting cash back from Detroit to pay for part of this Prince Fielder contract. But in return, Detroit is saving, I think, $75 million on the Fielder deal by getting rid of his contract. And now they have money to sign Matt Scherzer to a long-term deal.
I could care less about this deal. I just think the blockbuster trade is the most overrated aspect in sports. For the blockbuster, they love seeing headlines like this and then running to the press and saying, oh, now we have a Super Bowl contender. And you see this with a lot of teams, like teams that are in the position of the Tigers, who are so close and they get so close. Look at the Falcons. They're one move away from the Super Bowl, one play away, and they go and get Steven Jackson. So now everybody thinks they have the running game that they need to win a Super Bowl, and they're a mess. We've seen this with the Rockets in 1999. We've seen this with the Angels this past year, the Lakers. The examples go on and on. We're seeing this with the Brooklyn Nets right now, to where there's a blockbuster trade and these big names get shuffled around, but the one thing that people aren't accounting for is chemistry, is locker room synergy that takes time to develop for you to actually become a team, and that's why these always blow up in people's face. Yeah, there's exceptions to this rule, but more times than not, these blockbuster trades will not work out.
But I don't think this is a trade that is meant to elevate either team over the hump. This is a trade that both teams needed to make. Texas needed to make this trade to open up a spot for Profar, and Detroit needed to make this trade in order to get Fielder's contract off the books. I don't think this trade is going to make either team that much better or worse. So I don't think
me neither. I absolutely agree.
I mean,
I guarantee
blockbuster.
The narrative is going to not going to say that.
Well, I disagree. I think blockbuster, yeah, in terms of star power and the money involved, but I don't think we're going to hear narrative that, oh, Detroit's now the front runner in the AL Central, or they still they still have their own issues in terms of pitching and whatnot. So, but it's still, I mean, still a big deal for November. That's for sure.
Yeah, I mean, these were two of the top 10 teams in the American League, regardless, even if they hadn't made the trade. So it's not like, you know, all of a sudden Detroit went from, you know, the fifth best team in the American League to the first, or Texas went from the ninth best team in the American League to the first. They're still right around where they were before the trade. But I think it is a good trade for both teams. You got Prince Fielder, who's 29, and Kinsler, who's 31. So both guys are relatively still in their primes. You talk about the struggles that Prince Fielder had in the playoffs, which have been widely documented. But during the regular season, this dude was a beast for his 2 years in Detroit. You know, over 100 RBIs.
Not this year.
He had 106 RBIs. He batted 279, and so his average was a little bit down. Still had 25 home runs.
His homers are way down for him.
Yeah, he had a nice little season.
I mean, it's still, if we didn't put Prince Fielder to this guy's name, you know, you're taking 25 home runs, 106 RBIs,
not at that average. You know how much he's making? You expect a lot more from a guy who's making $200+ million than a 279, 25, 106 stat line. I mean, that his power numbers are headed in the wrong direction, and that's the red flag. I mean, maybe being in Texas will help him get the power back up, but that's not the numbers you want to see from a guy making that much money. That's why Detroit was so quick to trade him, because he's heading the wrong direction numbers-wise.
Yeah, but is that more Prince Fielder's fault or the Tigers for overpaying for him? Because we see this all the time where they chase numbers from the past, and you see these big contracts and you think to yourself, how are they going to live up to them? And really, $200 million, there's really no way to live up to that. I think there would be a way to rationalize the fact that he's not performing to his contract, maybe because nobody's worth $200 million in this day and age.
Yeah, it's not like he fell off like, you know, he didn't have a Josh Hamilton season.
I mean, listen, he just 6 years ago, he hit 50 home runs. So, you know, if he was hitting, you know, still 46, 50 home runs, then yeah, you can say, well, he's worth the money. But there's a lot of years in that contract still left for Tetris to take on, even with the financial assistance. So I totally get why Detroit made the deal. Hopefully a change of scenery will help him get his power back.
Yeah, and you mentioned that the financial assistance, $30 million going to the Rangers, which I think is also beneficial to them. But, you know, you talk about who is the face of the Texas Rangers. Who, like right now, who's the face of the Texas Rangers? Alfred?
Ron Washington.
Exactly. Ron Washington is the face of the Texas Rangers. And last I checked, Ron Washington ain't throwing no pitches. Ron Washington is not stepping into the batter's box. So, you know, I think this is a good move from the sense that you get a quality bat in the lineup. You know, he may not be as great as he was for those prime years in Milwaukee. But, you know, he's not Black Everson. Nobody's worth $200 million. But I think on average, Prince Fielder, you talk about the best first baseman in the league, Prince Fielder's going to be in that upper echelon.
I mean, offense is something Texas
has. It's not like he fell off like Ryan Howard, you know what I mean?
No, but offense is something Texas has never lacked. I mean, Texas, you know, didn't win this year not because of their offense, because they had a bunch of injuries on their pitching staff. So, yeah, it's great to have a superstar, quote-unquote, on your team. But, you know, in reality, they could hit with their current lineup. So, I just, you know, it's a risky move. They're on the hook for $138 million still after the help from Detroit. So, that's a lot of money. And, you know, they also have Nelson Cruz as a free agent this year. I don't know if they have the money to re-sign him. They still have Adrian Beltre under contract, so they're good at third base. But, you know, we'll see.
Yeah, I mean, you talk about having Beltre at third and Prince at first. That's a pretty good 1-2 pop right there.
Yeah, I mean, it comes down to the pitching. Like, Joe Nathan's a free agent. That's their star closer. They need to re-sign him, even though he's 38, but he's still effective. Offense has never been the issue for Texas, so it's great that they have another bat in that lineup in that ballpark, but at the end of the day, it's going to matter if their pitching staff is healthy. And to be fair, they had some bad luck. They had Matt Harrison, who was out for the season. Darvish, that banged up towards the end. I think Neftali Perez was hurt at one point. So, you know, they have the talent in the pitching staff. If they can stay healthy, they'll be fine in the AL West.
And let's not underestimate.
I just see that window closing. That's always a big if they can stay healthy. And, I mean, that's a lot of different scenarios that we're putting on there that all fall under contingency. So I'm not sure. I just feel like this window is closed for the Texas Rangers.
Well, no. I mean, a lot of their starters are pretty young. Darvish is 27. Feliz is 25. Matt Harrison's 28. Derek Holland's 27.
It's one thing to be young. It's another thing to be injury prone. Can they hold up? Ahmad Bradshaw's young. You know, there's a lot of people who are young, but you know, eventually you just get banged up, and maybe you can't hold up. The jury's still out on that.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say if it's injury prone. It just might be fluky. A lot of these guys that hurt for the first time this year, so we'll see.
Yeah, and you know, go back to Prince. You know, that's one thing you could never accuse Prince Fielder of, is being one of those injury prone dudes. You know, every year, you know, except for, you know, his rookie season, you know, he's played at least 157 games. So, you know, this is a guy that you could count on day in, day out to the lineup. And the other thing that I was going to say, Alfred, is we talked about Ron Washington earlier. I think the smartest move that the Texas Rangers made in the offseason was not getting rid of this dude, because, you know, he made chicken salad out of, like Marcus was saying, a lot of bad, fluky type of right. occurrences with this team last season. And so I think Ron Washington, you know, we all see the flamboyancy and the charismatic nature that he has in the dugout. But I think Ron Washington is the guy to lead this team into the future. And I think that window, it might not be as wide open as it was a couple years ago, but I think it's far from closed.
Yeah, let Ron Washington miss the playoffs next year. See what happens soon.
I'm saying, will we be talking about Ron in a future installment of Cracky Tales?
Yeah, you'll be unemployed.
You'll be like, live from downtown Arlington. Hey, baby, let me get some of that crack, baby. I got two American League championship rings, baby. Ron Washington, is that you? Hey, no need for names, baby. I hope they don't have my Uncle Ron, though, man. I am a Ron Washington fan, man. Like, since Jim Leland's no longer managing, like, Ron Washington just may be my favorite manager in all of baseball. So that is the baseball portion of the A block. And now we'll go to football, because that's what everybody wants to talk about. And, man, where do we start, guys? It was the call heard around the world on Monday night. You got RG3 and locker room dissension in Washington. And we got Manning versus Brady coming up this week.
Let's start Monday night first.
Monday night, Carolina and New England. And I don't know. Like, I want to hear your guys' take on the call and everything. And then I'll throw my two cents in. Alfred?
Well, basically the call that Nate is referring to is at the end of the game, Patriots and Panthers. Tom Brady goes to throw a pass into the end zone. It was a poorly thrown ball, but it was one that Rob Gronkowski may or may not have been able to get to. It
was held up
by Luke Kuechly. And the referees threw a flag, and they picked up the flag, and the game ended on the flag being picked up, saying that it was an uncatchable ball. It's not what they said at the time. They pretty much picked the flag up and said, everybody go home. But what the narrative is now is that there was an uncatchable ball, and a lot of people are up in arms. Here's what I think about the call. Just looking at it, it was a bang-bang play. Looking at it from in the actual speed, not slow motion, it looked like it should have been a flag. I don't really care that they did throw the flag. What I am peeved about is that they picked up the flag and just walked out and didn't explain anything. And now you have them going off the air with Tom Brady cussing out a ref. And it just didn't – it wasn't a good look for the NFL. Having said that, I really do think it was a bad call. Who's to say that was uncatchable given the athlete that Rob Gronkowski is? But big up to the Panthers. They just keep winning, and I really do think they outplayed the Patriots, and the Patriots would have escaped with one had they won that game.
Yeah, I think the refs dropped the ball and not explaining themselves in terms of the call itself. You know, if you're not going to call PI, at least got to call holding, at least, because that's what was going on in the end zone. Whether it was catchable or not, it's tough to say, because the defensive back was in Gronk's way, and the ball seemed to be underthrown. So even if Gronk was free, he would have to take out the DB in order to make that catch. So I just wish the refs did a better job of explaining the decision until, I mean, they did it after the game and they twitted the rule book and all that stuff. But I understand why Belichick and Brady were upset, because they didn't get a clear answer. And that's a, you know, when you're calling a play that decides the game, you need to explain yourself.
Yeah, first of all, I want to say I'm kind of peeved at Big Nasty for using the word peeved earlier. Like this,
it's a great word. It's that very underrated word.
That's that UC Santa Barbara education right there.
We got to get one peeved per segment.
Gosh darn it, I was so peeved at that call.
What peeved me this week?
I was downright miffed. But
that was bull crap.
But I kind of agree with Marcus. Like, I don't really have a problem with the call. It was borderline. But my problem with the officials is that, you know, the only explanation we got as a viewer was there's no penalty on the play, and then they just ran into the locker room. And you got – not only did you have Brady yell at the refs, but you had who's his backup?
Ryan Mallett.
Ryan Mallett. This is the most action I've seen Ryan Mallett get all season. Ryan Mallett barking at the officials as well. And, you know, I think it's one thing to have a controversial or disputed call, but it's another thing to not inform your viewers, inform the fan base, you know, inform the players, you know, what's really going on. I think that was where the NFL dropped the ball on that. But Patriots fans, let's be real with it. If there is any fan base in the National Football League that does not get to bitch and moan about borderline calls, it is you guys. I don't want to hear it. That's all I'm going to say about that, because I know we got a lot of Patriots fans that listen to the show. We thank you for listening. We appreciate your support of the show, but y'all can miss me with that.
Let me say, as a guy who hates the Patriots, at what point do they get to complain and they serve their punishment? Because
they got a lifetime ban on complaining. Right now, I put the Patriots in that OJ category. OJ can never get mad about getting stopped by a person any time in the rest of his life. You got away with murder, OJ, allegedly.
Patriots got away with murder, allegedly. Yeah, I mean, I get that, but that's now two of the three losses have been clouded by some.
I mean, the next time the Patriots get to complain is when they got a new coach. Like, Belichick, for the rest of his tenure, he can't complain. That's all I'm saying.
Okay, that's fair.
Once they hire a new coach, then okay, everything is reset. But Bill Belichick, nah, man. Go back to your house and play pirate dress-up time with your wife and be happy, man.
Is that what they do on the free time?
The Halloween, didn't you see the Halloween pics, man?
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, so be happy, Bill Belichick. Y'all are still in control of the AFC East and should have a pretty good playoff run. But staying on the East Coast to a group that is not so happy, the professional football team in Washington. Some people call them the Redskins. Lost to the surprising juggernaut Philadelphia Eagles led by Nick Foles. And instead of talking about the Eagles and taking control of the NFC East, all the talk after the game, guys, was about RG3, his interception that closed out the game, and then his comments in the post game that some people felt were him taking a shot at not only the coaching staff, but also the receivers and, you know, some of the other players on his team. And Santana Moss responded to that today and basically was like, if you're a leader, we need to hear more I statements or me statements instead of you statements and we statements. So what do you think about that, Big Nasty, all this dissension going on in D.C.?
Well, I just think they couldn't, the media and the teammates or whoever it is, the smear campaign on RG3, they couldn't wait for this to happen because he was such a darling last year. I mean, just universally renowned, and he was in all kinds of commercials, and he was a sweetheart. It really, you know, and it peaked when he got hurt in the playoffs, and I've never seen something like this. When he got hurt, they would cut to shots of the fans crying, and they would cut shots of the female fans, and they really painted this picture like this legend was dying on his last day. Maybe this is befitting for somebody like Brett Favre at the tail end of his career. Oh, this is sad, this legend going down. But RG3 is a rookie, and you just knew there was this love affair between RG3 and Washington and the media, and you knew that eventually there was going to be trouble in paradise, and he was going to wear out his welcome to some degree. Having said that, I think this is more of a Shanahan problem because let's face it, the Shanahans have really not delivered since coming to Washington. Let's always remember that they were 3-6 last year at some point before going on really was a fluky run to get to the playoffs.
All right, I got a stat for you, Alfred.
Go ahead.
Shanahan, if you take away the win streak last season, Shanahan 17-34 as coach of the Redskins.
And this would be his third double-digit loss season, I believe, with the Washington Redskins. Yep. And so I really think this is more of a – and he's got his son as the offensive coordinator. And the key problem right now we're talking about is the offense, and he's not going to fire his son. So if somebody needs to go, it clearly has to be Shanahan, because let's face it, when it comes to Shanahan, his legacy is directly tied to John Elway winning two Super Bowls while he was on the sidelines.
I totally agree. I think this is the final days of Mike Shanahan in D.C. I don't know what is, you know, we know his relationship with RG3 was rocky at best, so I'm sure RG3 will be in support of Shanahan leaving. At the same time, RG3 has his own issues in terms of, you know, I know he's coming back from an ACL injury, but, you know, a lot of people don't realize that in terms of his turnovers and fumbles, he's got an issue that he needs to get under control sooner than later, because he's getting up there in terms of, let me try to find a stat for you. In terms of turnovers, he's like Mark Sanchez level when it comes to fumbles. Continue on while I find the stat.
Well, you know, being up here in Virginia, you know, and right in Redskins country, quote unquote, I am well aware with the struggles and the drama that surrounds one Robert Griffin III, a.k.a. Black Jesus. So, you know, I think there's a couple things here. First of all, it's the relationship between RG3 and his coaching staff, you know, because his coaches, because if you have a problem with the offensive coordinator on any other team, you'd be able to go to the head coach and he'd be able to work something out. Or if you had a problem with the head coach on any other team, you could go to your OC and talk to him and you'd be able to work it out. But he can't do that in this situation because his head coach and his OC are having Thanksgiving dinner at each other's house. You know, he's like, how can you go to Mike Shanahan and say, hey, your son is messing this offense up? Or how can you go to Kyle Shanahan and say, you know, can you keep this between us? But, you know, I have a problem with the way coach is calling these plays. You know, there's no, you know, when you're in a regular job, you know, what is it, the hierarchy where you can kind of go and voice your grievances? He doesn't have
HR.
He doesn't have that structure, you know, that where, like, if I got a beef with my manager and I can't talk to my manager about it, I can go to her manager or the manager above that manager. There's no hierarchy like that in D.C. And so, you know, I think that RG3 would not be sad to see Shanahan go. But I think the other thing we need to talk about, you know, you mentioned the media, Alfred, and the media's contribution to this. And everybody's saying, you know, I've heard all these guys, Mark Schlereth and Teddy Bruschi and all these dudes come out and say, you know, RG3's got to take accountability and he's got to stop throwing guys under the bus. When a year ago, when Cam Newton and the Panthers were losing, and every single press conference after the game, Cam was like, you know, this is my fault. It's all on me. You know, I got to be better as a leader. I got to be better as a quarterback. I got to be better as a teammate. Every time they was like, Cam Newton, you know, this is not about you. This is about the team. It's like, what do you want? What do you want from these guys? You know, the media, y'all have to be consistent in the way that we cover these quarterbacks. You know, I know there's probably a lot of backlash internally from the media and as well as from the fans, because RG3, like Albert said, did get put on that pedestal when he came out of Baylor. But that's not his fault. He didn't ask for the prestige. He didn't ask for the fame. You know, he didn't ask for that Subway money. You know, but he, you know, he's going out there trying to make the best of what he can. And, you know, it was a terrible throw that ended the game against Philly on Sunday. But he's a second-year quarterback, and second-year quarterbacks make silly mistakes like that from time to time.
Speaking of RG3, I think he does control. I mean, he put himself out there a lot. He can control that. He decided to do every commercial that was asked of him, and, you know, you're running the risk of being overexposed by doing that. You know, guys can say, no, he doesn't need the money that bad. You know, he's getting paid already. So, yeah.
He
set himself partially for this. In terms of that number I was telling you about, so he's played in 25 career games. He's now fumbled 22 times. Only six of those fumbles for a loss. But that's a lot of time coughing up the ball. And eventually go ahead.
No, go ahead. No, go ahead, Mark.
No, and eventually that's going to, you know, that number won't be on your side. That number is going to work against you. And we've seen him run less this year, partially probably because his knee is not 100%. So, you know, I think next year is when we get a full assessment of what RG3 can do. He should be 100% healthy from the knee injury. He should have a new offensive coordinator in Washington, maybe someone who can work. Well, the Redskins have been good about working around him in terms of their playbook. But, you know, maybe someone who's not a Shanahan will help RG3. So you know, the jury's still out for RG3, and this season's pretty much a wash at this point.
Yeah, Marcus, and you said it already, but I was just going to follow up and say that, you know, the 12 fumbles he's had this year, he's only lost two of them. And traditionally in the NFL, you lose half your fumbles just based on the way the ball balances. In the last 50 years, teams lose an average of half their fumbles. So that number is going to even itself out. So as much as his fumble problems have happened, it's only going to get worse if he keeps fumbling the way he does, because then he'll start losing more of them.
And then you factor in the 15 interceptions in his 25 games. So he just needs to get it under control. And he could, for all we know.
Yeah, there was one shot during the broadcast on Sunday, and it was kind of like it was crazy how quick the internet hopped on it and turned it to a meme. But you remember the shot where it was right after he got sacked?
Yeah, his helmet was off. Yeah.
Yeah, his helmet was off, mm-hmm. and RG3 was looking up like, what happened was, you know, that to me is kind of a microcosm of this season for the Redskins. And so I think the thing that we need to find out, like Marcus was saying, is, was last year the fluke? Or is this year the fluke? And I think, you know, going back to Cam Newton, he had that amazing rookie season. Then he took a step back last year. And then this year, you know, we've seen that maturity, and he's, you know, got the Panthers in a position where they can, you know, contend for a playoff spot. And I think that's what it's going to be like for RG3, because, you know, we talk about the money and the commercials and all that stuff, but it's still a really young dude. And this is a phenomenon that we've only really seen maybe in the last 5 or 10 years, Marcus, where we – are rushing these cats out. And so, you know, back in the days when you had somebody like Steve McNair, they would have 2 or 3 years to sit and wait and learn. And so, you know, I think that in this accelerated kind of timetable for quarterbacks, we're going to see who can stay and who can't. But I think from what we've seen already from RG3, this dude has the skills, this dude has the talent. It's just a matter of him getting himself right, but also being with a coaching staff that can put him in the best position to succeed.
But along with the marketing and being out there and having these high expectations, there are professional reasons as to why he has these high expectations in terms of competitive reasons. Because we saw last year with Russell Wilson and Andrew Luck and RG3, we saw these rookies play so well, and there's a reason to that. We've seen Cam Newton play well as a rookie because it's easier to play quarterback in this day and age than any other era. And in addition to the fact that we've seen so many good young quarterbacks, now that bar is raised. So we can't use that excuse of, oh, well, he's a young guy, it's only his second year. This is like dog years in the NFL. This is like his seventh year based on how easy it is to play quarterback. And they're going to make it easier by saying that they have to change the way that quarterbacks get hit because too many quarterbacks are getting hurt. So I don't really think RG3 has that much time or should have that much time to grow or develop, as people are saying. I think next year, if he's not that guy, you've got to know then and there.
Speaking of quarterbacks, there's a great stat I saw on Twitter over the weekend that basically said that there's a group of backup quarterbacks. It was Nick Foles, Case Keenum, the guy in Chicago, what's his name, Josh McCown. It was like 5 or 6 quarterbacks who were backup quarterbacks. And for the season, they had thrown, I think, 32 touchdowns and no interceptions. This is before last Sunday's game. So just to prove your point, quarterback is the one position where it's becoming easier for people to plug in and go. And no matter if they're a rookie or not, I mean, we've seen Nick Foles, for example. I believe he leads the NFL in passer rating now. He's got 16 touchdowns, no interceptions. You know, so someone who, you know, we had a debate about 3 or 4 weeks ago after that Dallas game about whether he was good or not. He seems to be doing just fine now in that system. So, and just to mention, you know, Cam Newton, I don't think he took a big step back his second year. I think the big difference between the first 2 seasons and now is he's had a defense around him. You know, that Carolina defense this rookie year was awful. And you mentioned Keith early in that play in the Monday Night Football game. You know, he has turned into a star linebacker. And along with that defense, he has a three-headed running option with D'Angelo Williams, Jonathan Stewart, and Mike Tolbert now. So there are a few factors. Not to take away from Cam Newton what he's done this year, but Carolina as a whole, as a team, is much better than they were 2 years ago.
Absolutely, and it's not like Cam Newton is carrying that team to any degree. He had really a better statistical year in his rookie season because basically what they said is they're going to turn him loose. They said, we're not very good. We're just going to turn this kid loose, see what we got, have him throw every other play, and he lit the world on fire. Now that they've built around him, he could scale back. And to be honest, people may go crazy if they hear this. He's closer to Alex Smith than he is Colin Kaepernick, or at least when Colin Kaepernick was in his prime last year, because Cam Newton doesn't have to do as much. He doesn't have to put that team on his back, and so he's playing more within himself.
which is very true. And he needs to get credit for doing that, because I'm sure that was a tough adjustment for him, especially his rookie year where he 35 combined touchdowns. I mean, it was the Cam Newton show, and now he is just another part of that bigger puzzle. So I'm sure his ego might have taken a hit, but he's handled it well, and we've seen this win streak. I mean, for all we know, they could catch the Saints in that division. So,
yeah, to me, it's I am very interested in seeing what this group of young quarterbacks does going forward, and you know how we look back at this group in 10 years, because you know, like I said, I think I'm old school, and I think, you know, that there's a little bit too much acceleration. Granted, I understand what you're saying, Alfred, about the position being easy to play than in years past with all the rules, and, you know, you can't rush a sickle a quarterback anymore, as we saw in the Saints game. But I think that there's been a lot of guys that have flamed out as well, you know, and guys that I was high on when they came into the league. And Sam Bradford comes to mind, you know, I mean, maybe that's due to injury, but, I mean, that's a part of the equation as well. Matt Ryan from my Atlanta Falcons. It's like, you know, maybe the proof is starting to show up in the pudding now. You know, maybe this isn't the guy that can take you to that next level. He's a quality quarterback. He's a good quarterback. He's solid. But maybe, you know, he's just a 6 or 7 out of 10. Maybe he's not a franchise guy, you know. So I think that the way we rate and the way we define quarterbacks, it's going to change in the next couple of years, just based on the way the position, the way the game has changed and opened up. So, you know, I think RG3, if you're a Redskins fan, you got, like, that's your best option to win. And I think with or without Shanahan, you know, he's going to be the guy in D.C., you know. So I really think that this is a year that you can kind of write off, you know, coming back off an injury. But next year will be, you know, kind of what defines your franchise, whether it's still the Redskins or some other name, whether it defines your franchise for the next decade. So I think that's going to end off segment one, end off the A block this week. A lot of good topics, a lot of good discussions. We could sit here and talk about football all night, but there's an even more pressing concern, fellas. You know, football, it's all about winning. It's all about being victorious. But in wrestling, especially this time of the year, sometimes, Alfred, it's all about survival. So we're going to come back and talk about the Survivor Series, as well as the WWE's newest resident Power Ranger. And if you don't understand the reference, you will shortly. So stick and stay, because we got more Kings of Sport to come right after the break.
And now, it's time to get you caught up on the week's biggest stories from the world of professional wrestling. It's the Ringside Wrap on the Kings of Sport.
Welcome back to the Kings of Sport. Marcus, Nasty, and Nate. And by the time this podcast comes out, you're listening to us, I will be less than 1 month away from my trip back to the motherland, back to Liberia. And I'm going to spend a combined 16 hours on an airplane. I won't have Marcus to talk trash with. I won't have Nate to talk crack with. In fact, I'm not going to be talking that much at all. I'm going to be listening. And I'm going to be listening to audiobooks. Thanks in part to our sponsor at Audible.com. Audible.com is the premier provider of digital audiobooks. Audible has over 100,000 titles to choose from in every genre: thrillers, business, romance, comedy, sci-fi, and more. Audible titles play on iPhone, Kindle, Android, and more than 500 devices for listening anytime, anywhere, and for you. The listeners of the Kings of Sport podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you the opportunity to check out their service. Let me give you some of these titles. The Hobbit by J.R.R. Tolkien. The Witness by Nora Roberts. My personal favorite, Wrestling with the Devil, the Lex Luger autobiography. Go get it! To download your free audiobook today, go to audibletrial.com/thekingsofsport. Again, that's audibletrial.com/thekingsofsport for your free audiobook. And last week in our Invisible Mystery Show, I went ahead and started a tradition of suggesting a bonus audiobook that'll tie into what we're talking about. But that show's long gone, so let me try that again. And I'll suggest to you 12 Years a Slave, which is currently on audible.com. Very controversial book that's since been turned into a movie. And if you go see it, if you could take it, it's crazy, by Solomon Northup. And I talk about that because I'm just in a racially charged mood all of a sudden after Monday Night Raw. Raw went country. It was the gimmicky show that you would expect, the type of show that really was not appropriate for a Survivor Series go-home show. But what really stood out to me was the debut of Xavier Woods. Now, if you were to be told that WWE's got this guy with multiple educational bachelor's degrees, he's got a PhD candidate, he's almost a PhD, you would think, okay, maybe a professor gimmick, maybe a doctor gimmick, maybe a teacher gimmick, something that really shows how smart he is. But basically, Xavier Woods, who is a PhD candidate in real life, debuted as R-Truth's hype man. And when I say hype man, I mean hype. Like, this reminded me, if you watch Key and Peele, of that skit they did with the battle rap hype man. He didn't really say anything. He just, after every line that his battle rapper said, ah! Ah! And it was kind of a playoff of mice and men. Go see it if you haven't seen it. It was ridiculous. I obviously feel strongly about this, but I'm going to open it to you guys. We'll start with you, Marcus. What did you feel, if anything, about the Xavier Woods debut?
So, you know, as some of you know, I worked on evenings, and I have Raw on at work, so I had it on in the background, and I saw him come out, and nothing really stood out in terms of, oh, this is a red flag in terms of being offensive. And I just rewatched part of the segment now before the segment, and I'm torn. I don't know if part of that was because it was Raw Country, and they put him in that stupid hat and sunglasses as part of, you know, a country gimmick, quote unquote. But yeah, you mentioned in the background, you know, he is an educated guy. He's probably one of the smartest guys in the locker room. But at the same time, do I think a Dr. Dimmitt or a David Otunda type Dimmitt would get over? I'm not sure. So I want to give his character at least another week before I come down on WWE for having another guy who, you know, shuts and jive.
Yeah, first of all, Alfred, shout out to the Key and Peele reference.
That skit.
That was pretty noise. Yeah, but man. I think the problem here is they don't know what to do with this kid yet. You know, is his gimmick going to be, is he a smart guy? Is he a dancer? Is he a hype man? Is he a nerd shouting Power Rangers catchphrases? Or what I thought when I saw him on Monday Night Raw this past Monday, I was like, is that Rockwell?
Oh,
I'm like, he about to come out to the ring. When I come home at night, I shut the door real tight. That's going to be his gimmick. He's always paranoid. He's like, I always feel like somebody's watching me. But I'm kind of torn too, like Marcus said. I think, you know, as a TNA fan, I thought it was kind of cool that, you know, they teamed him up with R-Truth because they did have a short-lived tag team in TNA. But if this is all he's going to be, this generic hype man, this generic black dude, like the WWE, for all intents and purposes, they have basically three categories of black guys. There's the servant, there's the criminal, and there's the happy-faced Negro. And it looks like so far, just after 1 week, granted it's only been a week, But Xavier Woods is kind of filling into that, you know, that happy-faced Negro. I'm going to sing, I'm going to dance, I'm going to shuck and jive and shout Power Rangers catchphrases. So I'm not sure what I think about the character yet, Alfred.
Two things. One, he's been doing the Power Rangers thing since NXT, so this isn't, like, something that's totally new. Number two, on the same show we had Biggie Langston win the Intercontinental title, and it seems like he is well on his way to becoming a contender for the world heavyweight title, or even bigger. So, where does Biggie Langston fit into your stereotype model in terms of one of those three categories? His current character.
Did you say the thug? I mean, there's always exceptions to rules. So if you have 10 examples of how WWE has bettered the African-American, and remember, Biggie Langston is new, so we still got time to see some crazy stuff with him. Here's what my problem is. I really don't mind so much. WWE has trained its audience to look at the black wrestler as an entertainer. Okay, fine. I'm not okay with that. But if I'm going to watch wrestling, I can't just sit here and let that ruin me. The thing is, there is a guy in Xavier Woods, who, as we said, has this strong educational background, and it just tells me that Vince McMahon's social commentary on the world, which is played out through the WWE product, he just sees black people as just any other black guy. That's just the next guy in line. We're just going to roll him out, team him up with another African-American. This is an organization that has gone on record of saying, Michael Hayes, well, you know, being black is a gimmick. This is an organization that told me personally that because they have the Junkyard Dog in the Hall of Fame, they should be absolved of any type of racially insensitive booking of a black man in chains. So, you know, you guys say, oh, it's only been a week, this, that, and the other. No, the WWE has lost the benefit of the doubt. I have pretty much made up my mind on this. Now, what my hope is, if I was a little less, a little more naive, my hope would be that this is just a big setup for Xavier Woods to act a fool, shuck and jive for a couple weeks, and then turn on our truth and really start a character in him that we haven't seen really in WWE, of a man who is tired of people like R-Truth rapping and shucking and jiving and making him look bad. You don't even have to directly say why, but you could have that racially sensitive type of storyline, and it could connect with some people. I just don't think WWE would know how to pull off that plight of the educated black man.
There's no way, but there's no black writers from what we know, so there's no way they can pull off that angle.
And two points. One, Marcus, you know, in terms of Big E, you know, I agree. I like what they've been doing with Big E Langston lately, but I think it's only a matter of time before we see him as the happy face big dude, like what they did with Mark Henry for so many years. But what Alfred was saying about, you know, having a black character as the conscientious dissenter and is saying, you know, I'm not going to be a part of this buffoonery. They tried it before with Shelton Benjamin. I don't know if you guys remember that.
They did. I remember that. I remember him
Shelton,
saying that
instead
one line.
Of being a guy that we looked at and said, hey, that guy's making a lot of sense, they had all the other characters react to that guy as if he was the idiot.
Right. And the way they did that, it was a backstage segment, and he said one line, and I remember it because I got so excited about it, like, oh, wow, we might have something. But like, as was the career of Shelton Benjamin, after he said that line, they just went on to the next thing and said, well, that's not going to work. Let's do something else. So they never really ran with that. That is something WWE could, again, if they had the Patrice O'Neils, if they had somebody in that writing team who can speak to problems like this that would connect with a largely mainstream audience, then yes, this is something that I feel could have some longevity. It's just that I don't trust this company to really know what to do with somebody with a PhD.
The thing is, do they even care? I mean, I talked to people online that night during the Raw Goes Country show, which was offensive for a number of reasons. As being somebody that lives in the South, that was a piss-poor representation of what country life and country wrestling is all about, but that's neither here nor there. But in terms of Xavier Woods, what I got from a lot of people online was that, you know, hey, the WWE writes for their audience, and their audience is mostly white, so why are you complaining? I mean, we got guys like Kofi, you know, Kofi's a good guy, why are you complaining? And it's like, if you don't write above your audience, I'm not saying you have to be some highbrow masterpiece theater program, but if you don't elevate the expectations of your audience, then it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. They're always going to expect the lowest common denominator in terms of your entertainment because that's what you're giving them.
And that in and of itself is the biggest problem for me, is that WWE, again, has been trained to view these wrestlers as just entertainers, and it's really not a big deal to most people to see Xavier Woods do this.
I still say we need to give it more than 1 week because who knows what where they're going with this character. I'm not trying to defend the WWE, but I'm just saying it seems like, you know, we really don't know if this is a one-time deal with R-Truth, if he's going to be R-Truth's tag team partner going forward. So I just want to give it more than 1 week. Also, as I told you guys earlier in the week, we're talking about a guy who whose gimmick before this, before he got to WWE, was Apollo Creed. So really, like, I don't know. It's a step up. Trust me. It's a step up what he's doing now as opposed to what he did in TNA.
It's a step up in terms of a paycheck. I'll give you that. But
in terms of a gimmick, you think he'd rather be playing Apollo Creed than playing R-Truth's partner?
Yeah, it's a lateral move to me. At best.
No. Yeah, me too. I don't think it's one is worse than the other. Because it's not like he was playing Kunta Kinte. Is there anything really? But Apollo Creed was actually a respectable cat. Nobody looks at him as the buffoon. But Apollo Creed was based on Muhammad Ali when they made Rocky. So, you know, I know where you're going with this, Marcus. And I see where you're coming from. But as if I compare Apollo Creed to somebody who he doesn't have a speaking role and he is the guy who doesn't talk in a duo where the guy who does talk is a rapper who says, what's up? I just think that is a huge step down.
Let's see where
Maybe things will change. Maybe it'll be morphing time someday for Xavier Woods' character.
We'll wait this out. Marcus wants to give it another week, and I would be glad to see where this goes. Hopefully it goes somewhere. But WWE does not have another week to do a go-home show, and I bet you they wish they did because this was one of the most discombobulated shows I've ever seen the WWE put on. I am not excited for Survivor Series in any way, shape, or form whatsoever. I remember they were talking about canceling Survivor Series a couple years ago, and really it wasn't Survivor Series' fault. I know it's kind of a played-out concept, but they could have preserved that concept and made it a big deal, but they didn't. And it seems like they're on that path again. And I could see them looking at what Survivor Series is going to do and seeing a poor buy rate and wanting to cancel it again. Are you guys excited for Survivor Series? We'll start with you, Nate.
Not really. I mean, I'll probably watch it. I'll probably give the good people in the first means a call on Sunday and watch it. But, I mean, I think there were two problems in terms of the go-home show. I think if you're going to do a go-home show, it has to be a go-home show. It can't be a gimmick show. And so either this show, the Raw Goes Country, it needed to happen a week earlier, or the previous week's show, that needed to be your hard sell for Survivor Series. There was a lot of stuff, you know, with the Vicky Guerrero match and the Brad Maddox match and stuff like that, that it detracted from what's going to be going on Sunday. I think there are some good matches on the card, but I don't think there's a lot of interest. There's not a lot of excitement behind them. And then, you know, going back to Raw, you talk about Rey Mysterio showing up at the last minute. It's like, you know, where does Rey fit in to Survivor Series, and if at all?
In terms of what he's going to be doing on Sunday?
Yeah.
He's in that match.
Yeah, they just announced it, like, I think minutes after Raw went off
the air. He's the surprise wrestler in that Cody Rhodes match.
Okay.
Yeah, there's nothing on this card that excites me. I mean, I don't need to see a rematch of Biggie Langston and Curtis Axel. We just saw it. I don't need to see another John Cena Alberto Del Rio match. We've seen it. I don't need to see Punk and Bryan versus the Wyatts. The Divas
match.
That would
have been an opportunity right there, Marcus. You know, Alfred was talking about the traditional Survivor Series matches. You could have had a hell of a Survivor Series match, you know, with Punk, Bryan, and the Cody Rhodes and Dustin Rhodes against, you know, the Shield and the Wyatt family. That'd have been a cool match right there.
Yeah, yeah.
And it looked like that's where they were going. And if you saw how they went off to the air, it was so well done 2 weeks ago when they were in Manchester. And they had the tease, and they were just teasing the showdown and teasing it. And the crowd was so bloodthirsty, and they were getting so into it that finally they had this huge melee, and they were chanting, "This is awesome." If that was the go-home show, even if they hadn't announced a match on the show, I would have been excited for Survivor Series. But they just took a huge step back, and I really don't see how they're going to be able to salvage the show.
Yeah, I don't... There's nothing really. I mean, Randy Orton bit show doesn't really do it for me either. So, I mean, I was actually kind of excited about the surprise mystery partner, and they blew that on Monday. So now that that's gone, I really have no interest in anything on this show.
Where's Survivor Series taking place, Albert?
Boston.
Massachusetts. Scenic country.
Okay.
Even though they're going to be booing him.
Yeah. Well, Sin's used to that. He got booed on Sports Nation. I'm like, how do you get booed on a TV show, man? Are you the special guest?
Yeah, and I think that might have been something WWE did. Like, holy crap, nobody's excited for this pay-per-view. Let's try to roll out our big stars on as much television as possible to kind of promote this thing because they need it.
So do you see any big changes occurring on a Sunday, or is it just going to be status quo?
No. I see status. I can't see the Big Show winning the WWE title, especially, I mean, that program, it's a WWE title program, and it was over and done with by, like, the first hour, and you didn't hear from either of them for the rest of the show. It looked like they were booking that as an Intercontinental title program, really disservice to the WWE title. So I just see it status quo.
Yeah, status quo. I don't see anything changing. At this point, I'm really counting down until that first Raw of the new year, because that's usually when they decide to kick it up a notch and start building towards the Rumble, which, you know, builds to WrestleMania. But between now and December 31st, it's pretty much going to be, I mean, especially with the holidays, too, with the way they tape Raw and SmackDown, I don't really expect anything special to happen between now and the rest of the year.
Yeah, you brought up a good point, Alfred. I guess we can kind of go off with this in terms of the Big Show and Orton. It did seem rather odd that I think that they closed out the first hour with that confrontation.
Yes.
And then that was all that we heard from those two guys for the remainder of the show. It's like, do you think, you know, I know we were talking a couple weeks ago in terms of going by the storyline logic, the Big Show should get his comeuppance. He should win the title, even though nobody wants to see that. Do you feel that they're going to put the title on Big Show at some point, if not Sunday? Will we see that? Or is this just kind of a placeholder feud for Randy Orton until, you know, maybe D. Bryan or somebody of that nature?
Yeah, it's absolutely a placeholder. I just feel like they're doing this with the Big Show because they know Big Show is never – he's not a type of person who should win a WWE title and even be somebody to carry a company. He's an attraction. And they know that for a couple months, they're going to look at him as a glue that holds the company together in terms of the WWE title picture. But even having said that, the way they booked Randy Orton – you know, Big Show obviously is a babyface in this, but now Randy Orton is having tension with the Authority for whatever reason – What is their logic with that? Randy Orton should be as big of a heel going into this pay-per-view as anybody so that people could want to pay to see him lose. But I kind of came out of this program like, man, they're kind of trying to stack the deck against Randy.
Yeah, that whole storyline is starting to confuse me. It seems like, I don't know what's going on. But the one thing I do expect the Monday after Survivor Series is the return of Mark Henry and him to either get himself involved with Randy Orton or John Cena for a title match in December. I don't know which way they want to make this character now, but I can see him being especially.
They got three choices, Marcus.
I mean babyface or heel.
He could be a babyface thug, a heel thug, a babyface.
And I think they're going to make him corporate. They've done it with everybody else. They got, what, six, seven?
He shaved his head. Yeah.
And he might come out big old suit like I'm the director of operations, so the bureaucracy continues.
So we'll have Triple H, we'll have Stephanie, we'll have The Shield, we'll have Bull Shannon from Night Court, aka Kane, and we'll have Rick Ross, aka Mark Henry, all on one side.
Vince McMahon will come back. The board of directors always puts their nose at everybody's booking matches these days.
So who do you think is going to be the guy that eventually overcomes all this? Because I think they've lost faith in Bryan.
I do too, and it's still a long shot, but I really do think they're booking this angle for Stone Cold Steve Austin to come and save the WWE. I know that maybe he won't come back, and he's just been saying too many times in interviews, he's made it a point to say, oh no, I'm not coming back, oh no, there's no way. I just think he's in the headlines so much for somebody who's not coming back to the WWE, and this is WrestleMania 30, and when Vince wants somebody, he gets
Orton Austin headline at WrestleMania 30?
Wait, coming back to wrestle? No. Or just coming back to
wrestle?
Oh, you're high.
Coming back to wrestle. Triple H. That is a pipe dream, and I understand that, but I could see Stone Cold Austin. Yet never, ever say ever. So, never say never. So, he's in great shape.
So, people, just so we're keeping track here, this is the same guy who said Ultimate Warrior in the Rumble? Is that correct?
Ultimate Warrior, surprise, Rumble.
Hulk Hogan wrestling at Mania, and now Stone Cold Steve Austin wrestling at Mania. This is
Hulk Hogan. I wouldn't commit to Hulk Hogan wrestling. I could see Stone Cold Steve Austin because remember, their plans from backstage were that Stone Cold Steve Austin would come back as the guy once Triple H runs wild with the WWE, gets out of control. Vince would disappear for a while and come back with a savior. And that savior right now as a placeholder is Stone Cold Steve Austin. They're not confident they can get him. But if Vince McMahon in WrestleMania 30 season opens up that wallet, Stone Cold Steve Austin's going to dust off those knee braces and he's going to get back into a ring. Believe that.
Hulk Hogan has a better chance of wrestling than Steve Austin at WrestleMania.
Yeah, I agree with Marcus.
That might be true, but you never say never, and who knows what that means right now with WWE the way they book. Okay, let's go to our picks for Survivor Series. We're going to do the three big matches, Randy Orton, Big Show, John Cena, Del Rio, and then the, I'm not even going to say all the names, the big CM Punk, Daniel Bryan, Team Babyface versus Team Heel with the Survivor Series. I have Randy Orton going over, John Cena going over, and let's say that the Wyatt family, the Heel team going over CM Punk and Daniel Bryan.
I have Orton, Cena, and the Wyatts because there's some dissension between Punk and Bryan. They start planting that seed now.
Yeah, I say I agree with Marcus. The Heels win the tag match. I think Orton retains, waiting for that big matchup with Stone Cold or maybe Hulk Hogan.
It's happening.
Where do you get this big boot with these J's on, brother?
Never say never, brother.
But I not only do I think Cena retains against Del Rio, but I think even though that's the lesser title, maybe I think it's because they're in Boston and they want to get the fans a quote-unquote happy ending. That closes the show.
And I will throw in a bonus. I do like the Rhodes and Goldust Rose Dynasty babyface team to go over in that group Survivor Series match. But we go from the Rhodes Dynasty to a hip-hop dynasty that may be on their way back. More Kings of Sport on the way. I've never seen a diamond in the flames. I cut my teeth on wedding rings in the movies. And I'm not proud of my address. In the torn up town, no postcode envy. But every song's like,
we've always said the Kings of Sport was the best podcast around, but now the reviews are in and the people have spoken. Here's what you had to say about the show. This is a sports podcast for the people, by the people. There are no old guys talking about the good old days. These are brothers that are connected to what's going on now. They bring you the latest information as well as comparing current events to historical ones. If there is one sports podcast that you need to listen to, make it this one. This is a very good show with three brilliant co-hosts who keep it real. Younger guys with great minds for sports. They have differing opinions and back it up with facts and figures. Always entertaining and an enjoyable listen. I am down with the Kings. The Kings of Sport is the best thing going on the internet. These guys rock. Give them a listen. You won't be disappointed. So there you have it. But you don't have to take their word for it. Find out for yourself. Listen to the Kings of Sport and make up your own mind. We guarantee we're the best show around.
The Kings of Sport, America's favorite race-themed sports podcast. Shout out to USA Today. I'm the guy, Father Nathan, joined as always by Big Nasty Africano and Marcus Vandenberg. And fellas, it's that time once again. We close out the show each and every week with segment four, a journey, an adventure, if you will, into the world of wretchedness and all around foolishness in the world of sports and pop culture. And I think we need to start, since this is the Thanksgiving season and there's so much to be thankful for, and we got to send a shout out to our Native American brothers and sisters for all that they did to help make this great country. I think there's no better way to honor the Marcus than to start with this story, which comes from nowhere else but the great state of Alabama.
Yeah, there is a playoff game on Friday, high school football, where, let me find the name of this team here, McRoy, I can't pronounce his name, high school, faced up against Pinson Valley High. This was in Alabama, and they had, you know, traditionally teams run through a big paper banner, especially in high school. Well, this banner was, it had to be a good, 20 feet high, maybe. And the banner read, "Hey, Indians, get ready to leave in a trail of tears, round two." And of course, the mascot's name is the Indians, but of course, the students and adults and whoever let this get on the field didn't take into consideration that that is an insensitive comment towards the Native Americans. And considering you mentioned this was the state of Alabama, nothing surprises me when it comes to race relations in the South.
I understand that the kids, I mean, then again, what are they teaching these kids in Alabama in their history classes? But the kids might have not been savvy enough or well-read enough to understand the connotations of what the sign said. But a teacher, a coach, an administrator, somebody had to see that sign and say, maybe talking about the Trail of Tears isn't the best thing to do, especially in this festive Thanksgiving season, Big Nasty.
And especially if it says, "Hey, Indians." I know, like Marcus said, it's their team mascot, but it just looks so ugly and racist. And this is a type of display and stunt that now it's got national recognition. It's going to give anti-Redskin guy some fuel and ammo as to why football teams shouldn't be named after Indian tribe or Native American tribes or any type of nickname that has to do with Native Americans that would be perceived as offensive, is that you run into situations which it's a rotten apple type thing. One rotten apple doesn't spoil it for the whole bunch, but you could run into a situation like this and you're basically feeding into it by calling a team Redskins. What some people think.
Yeah, and this is why there's such a strong number of people who don't find the term Redskins offensive, because there's stuff that happens like this that gets by or is accepted by people. So, you know, it doesn't surprise me at all. And at this point, I've been beaten down by stories like this that I've given up in terms of caring. Like, it just seems like this is continuing to happen, not just in the South, to be fair, you know, across the United States. There are stories like this that involve, insensitivity to different races. And unfortunately for this one involved Native Americans.
Yeah, and I guess the silver lining to the story is that, you know, there was awareness raised, and now these kids are aware of what's the Trail of Tears and some of the hardships that the Native American people went back through in the 1800s, what that was all about. But also the McAdory, whatever their name is, they moved on. They beat the Indians, and they will compete next week in the playoffs against Southside High. And Southside High's mascot, fortunately for everyone, is the non-racial Panthers.
So they not racial about a Black Panther.
I mean, hopefully it's not a Black Panther, but hopefully it's just a regular old, just a garden variety Panther, and they can make their angry signs and nobody will get offended. But if it's a Black Panther, we might have a Malcolm State situation on our hands. Like, what do you mean get rid of the Black Panthers? Like, go back to your own country, Black Panthers.
And again, not to defend them or defend the South, but it's not limited to just the South. Schools don't really teach the Trail of Tears. None of my friends growing up knew about it. People I know ever since migrating to LA don't know what the Trail of Tears is. Schools just don't teach it. It's in our history books, and what they teach inside those books aren't very accurate, but it was never a point of emphasis. It's something that America kind of looks at as their dirty little secret. So for students to think that this type of mention isn't that offensive, I completely understand why they would think that.
That's a good point, because I never learned that in high school. So, yeah, I mean, I totally get what you're coming from. So I just think about it now. I never, you know, learned that in school.
Not only did I learn about it in high school, they showed us a movie about it. So, I'm a little bit older than you, Cass, but it was a movie. It was, like, part real but also part animated. And I think the movie started off with it was like these kids. It was a young Native American boy, a white boy, and like a black girl. And they was asking what was the Trail of Tears about. And it was the old Native American grandfather, whatever. And as he started to tell a story, we got an animated depiction of the Trail of Tears. And it was like the most scarring thing to an 11-year-old Nate Milton. I'm just like looking at this, like these animated Indians dying on the trail and being dehydrated, having no food, and being forcefully relocated. And I was just like,
that's so was it violent?
It wasn't necessarily violent, but it was a little too graphic for a 11 to 12-year-old.
Because I was going to say, if it was animated and they made fun of it, I would say that's worse than not telling
it at all. It was very serious in tone. Okay. It was very, like, it was, but it was one of those, like, old school, like, late 80s, late 70s, early 80s type of movies. Like, you could tell, like, when they were probably some liberal person in New York made the videos and sent them out to everybody. But it was just an animated depiction of the Trail of Tears, and it was like had the Indian and just the sad faces, and they're very gaunt and no food. And it was just like come on, man. I can't be watching all this for recess, baby. I got a big kickball game to think about. I mean, I'm sorry it's terrible what happened, but I'm just a kid right now. I can't be dealing with all this. But yeah, so hopefully these kids will get it, and you know. It is another example in the book of why we are not in a quote unquote post-racial society. So that's that story. But let's go from one insensitive topic, Marcus, to another with one of America's favorite boxing personalities, and that's one Freddie Roach.
Oh, Freddie. So if you didn't hear about the story last night from Macau, on site of the Manny Pacquiao Brandon Rios fight this weekend, both camps are out there in Macau training for the fight on Saturday, and they are sharing a gym space within the casino at the Venetian. And Pacquiao and Freddie Roach came in for their session, which was slated to start at 11 o'clock, and Robert Garcia, who trains Brandon Rios, were still in the gym, and this upset Roach. Roach called Garcia a piece of shit, and he told, let me just read the story so I get the stories right. Well, the bad story is this. So before we get into the incident, Manny Pacquiao trained by Freddie Roach, but Pacquiao also had a conditioning coach, Alex Ariza, who had been with Pacquiao for a while now. And, Freddie Roach and Alex Ariza always butted heads, and finally, Pacquiao and Roach made the decision to let Ariza go, and they went their separate ways. Now, Ariza, this is probably smart and Robert Garcia's fault. Robert Garcia's part brought Ariza on for this fight, so now we have a conditioning coach that used to train Pacquiao in Rios' camp. So, Alex Ariza and Robert Garcia are there, and according to Kevin Ioli of Yahoo Sports, Rios conditioning coach Alex Ariza, who was fired by Roach as Pacquiao's strength and conditioning coach, told Roach to get the fuck out the gym. Roach responded by saying, "Make me get out." Ariza mocked Roach's Parkinson's disease several times. At one point, Ariza took a step forward and kicked Roach in the chest. As the chaos broke out, Ariza said to Roach, "You're a fucking joke," and then used a gay slur. This is all caught on camera, so you can be the judge of who did what and who escalated what. But Just looking at the tape last night and going through it, it seems like Roach was in the wrong for stepping to Darcia's camp and Rios's camp. And if you listen closely, Roach does say something that gets under the skin of Garcia, and you hear Garcia basically say, you know, you're getting racial on me. But this is not the type of promotion that Top Rank and the boxing world needed before this fight on Saturday, and it probably makes people look twice when it comes to Freddie Roach.
Yeah, and maybe Roach was in the wrong, but this has been brewing for a while between him and Ariza. Ago, Alex Ariza mocked Freddie Roach's Parkinson's in a video, and Freddie Roach says that they came to terms and it was okay and it was water under the bridge. But I think that's part of what may have sparked this, is that Freddie Roach maybe delivering a receipt, not doing a very good job of it, but trying to deliver a receipt. And again, like Marcus was saying, this is the worst type of promotion that this fight can get. You're talking about Manny Pacquiao, who 2-3 years ago was the biggest, like 1A to Floyd Mayweather's one of the biggest stars in boxing. A Mayweather-Pacquiao fight was going to set the world on fire, but now you've seen him look worse every fight. He's not the same dude, and this trainer fight is more of a story than the fact that Manny Pacquiao was fighting Rios. I mean, it really speaks to the downfall of Manny Pacquiao, if you ask me.
Yeah, first of all, I'm going to get serious here in a second, but the first thought that popped into my head while Marcus was describing the fracas that went down between Roach and Garcia was, I don't know if you remember that Boondocks episode where Colonel Stinkmeaner inhabited Tom's body.
No.
And Tom ended
I think
up,
I saw it.
And Tom kicked that dude in the parking lot. And he was like, oh, look at you. You was talking all that good stuff just a minute ago.
Yeah,
look
yeah,
at you now. You're on the ground, and you got kicked in your chest. And I can just imagine that's what was said to Freddie Roach in the aftermath. But, I mean, this is crazy because this is a guy, Freddie Roach, that, you know, he's a Hall of Famer, right, Marcus?
Been Correct, he is. Yes, recent Hall of Famer.
Yeah, been inducted into the Boxing Hall of Fame for all his great work as a trainer. You know, he's got Parkinson's, so he's a role model in that sense, you know, doing work to try to raise awareness and look for a cure for that. But just because you're good in some aspect of your life, that don't give you that doesn't give you license to talk reckless. And if you have a history of talking reckless, it will catch up to you eventually. And you know, I'm not sure who's right, who's wrong here. You know, I think everybody's a little bit wrong in this particular situation. You know, like you were saying, Marcus, there is some history between the guys, but you know, it's just a bad look for boxing, and it's a sport that really can't afford any more bad looks. You know,
they're both in the wrong. I mean, there is no winner out of this situation. And it's curious to see if this will have an impact on Saturday's fight. You know, Rios and Pacquiao came into this week having mutual respect for each other, to the point where it was addressed, I believe, in the 24/7 episode, I think, where the topic of them coming up and traveling to the Dundas press tour, you know, was brought up. They seem to be, you know, getting along pretty well. So now you throw in this factor, and you know, the last thing Pacquiao needs is another distraction. It's bad enough that he's had to deal with the aftermath of the typhoon in the Philippines. You know, he's coming off a devastating loss to Marquez. So, you know, it's, and also on top of that, the other news that broke last night was that one of his de facto advisor suffered a heart attack in Macau. So he's also dealing with that issue. So it just seems like we're setting up for the line of excuses on Saturday night if he is to be defeated by Brandon Rios, which I think he will be.
Yeah, and I think, you know, maybe unfortunately, Marcus, and, you know, it's kind of a commentary on the state of boxing currently, that maybe this fracas, this dust-up, it might have drawn more eyes to the fight, which is sad to say because, you know, it should be a good fight. You got Rios 31-1, you got Pacquiao 54-5. Like you said, you know, coming off of a couple of bad losses, really looking to reestablish himself. I think that, unfortunately, because of what went down with Freddie Roach, more people know about this fight than they did, you know, 24 hours ago.
And that's when I was I found out about this on Twitter, and when I saw people reacting to it, a lot of people were saying, I didn't even know Pacquiao was fighting this weekend. So the fact that they were getting along leading into this, okay, that's great for sportsmanship and whatnot. But if you want to sell a fight, people want to believe inherently that two guys do not like each other. That's what we've seen in the greatest fights when it comes to Pacquiao and Mayweather. If that was to ever come to commence, because Pacquiao and Mayweather don't like each other. You see Mayweather make all kinds of inflammatory remarks about Pacquiao on videos, and that's why that would be a good fight. And that's what's made Mayweather so brilliant, is that he wants to be the bad guy. He wants to be the antagonizer and try to create conflict. And so this maybe is what this fight needs to at least garner some more buzz heading into Saturday's fight.
Yeah, you know what this reminds me is actually the build for this fight reminds me sort of the UFC card this past weekend with Chael Sonnen and Rashad Evans. You know, Chael Sonnen is someone who is very vocal when it comes to his opponents, but he actually is co-workers with Rashad and good friends with Rashad. So I totally forgot that Chael was actually fighting on that card until Saturday night, because we didn't hear the vocal Chael, because these two guys have mutual respect. So, and the fight turned out to be a dud, but you know, you need two guys to really be on opposite sides to really sell a fight, and especially a fight that is not taking place in the United States. You know, you have people who are going to think, oh, well, this fight's taking place in Macau, which means it's not going to air at the usual time, which it is. I think people don't know that. They haven't done a good job of educating people that this fight will be taking place at, you know, 9 Eastern, 6 Pacific, and, you know, everything's the same for the U.S. customers. It's only going to be different for the fighters in Macau. So I'm not expecting a, you know, big numbers for this fight in terms of pay-per-view buys. It's a big payday for Pacquiao because he's not paying taxes on this money, so he's taking home $18 million guaranteed, plus he could get up to $30 million based on pay-per-view sales. So in terms of for the future of boxing, yeah, we could see more fights in Macau. Someone like Floyd Mayweather comes to mind in terms of someone who's about his money. If he can go to fight in China and not only build his international brand, but take home more money off the top without getting taxed, you know, I could see it happen.
I agree. You know, and I think, again, it's a shame that that's what it takes to kind of get people's interest and make people pay attention. But, you know, it is the current state of the sport. But a sport that is thriving, a sport that is healthy, at least one company in the sport, is mixed martial arts and is the UFC. And you mentioned UFC 167. From Saturday night, and besides the fight between Chael Sonnen and Rashad Evans, who I will always think of as the WB Frog in my mind, thanks to that one season of The Ultimate Fighter, with Rampage Jackson and who's that boy, Titties? The Titties gonna fight tonight. Titties gonna fight. But we had the big fight between George St. Pierre and Johnny Hendricks, and you know, there was a lot of discussion not only about the fight, you know, where GSP won a split decision, a controversial split decision, but also some of the comments and talk afterwards in terms of, is GSP retiring? Is he taking some time off? What's going on here? What's going on there? And you know, it's been I think the aftermath of the fight was actually almost as interesting as the fight itself. So Marcus, for those that are not MMA aficionados, why don't you catch them up to speed?
Yeah, so before this fight, there was a lot of buzz about, is, you know, could this be it for GSP if he win or lose? And you mentioned the ending to that fight. GSP ended up retaining his title by scores of 48-47, 47-48, 48-47. Split decision for GSP, and a decision that I had Hendricks winning. I had Hendricks winning round one, and, you know, I thought he won the fight. Whether it was a robbery like Dana White claimed or whatnot, that's another story. But after the fight, Joe Rogan's in the ring, and you could tell GSP had something on his mind and something he wanted to say, and Rogan pushed him on it, and GSP basically said that he needed to hang up his gloves for a little bit and take some time off, and, you know, he didn't know if he would be coming back.
I think we're close to the end of GSP. I don't think this was the robbery that a lot of people are making it out to be. Dana White didn't help that cause by saying that the governor needs to come out or whatever he said. He was just out of his mind. I really do think it was a close fight. I think Hendricks won. I think what happened is that GSP won the final round, and that just kind of resonated with the judges. And that's what I hate about the human element of judging is judges, when it comes to a championship fight, are going to give the edge to a champion. And I don't agree with that. I think you score the fight, and whoever wins, wins on points, and you give him the title. You don't say, well, he didn't beat the champion soundly. Hendricks won that fight. Eyeball test, and you look at the way a lot of people were scoring it. It looks like 65% of people who scored that fight thought that Hendricks won the fight. And if you watch GSP's last few fights in the welterweight division, Carlos Condit really took it to him. At one point, it looked like he had stopped GSP. His face was a mess after that fight. And then you watch the Nick Diaz fight. Nick Diaz wasn't right, and I think if Nick Diaz was right, and if he would have gone through with that fight and not have gotten suspended and all the crap that happened there, Nick Diaz could have beaten GSP. Rory McDonald, I think, could easily handle GSP, even though he did get upset, which was a bad matchup against Robbie Lawler. GSP has Rory McDonald in his back pocket. They're boys, and so they train together, so he's been able to avoid him. But I do think GSP's number is coming up, and the next time he fights Hendricks, I don't think it's going to be that close at all. I think it's going to play out like BJ Penn when he fought Frankie Edgar. And the second fight, you saw Frankie Edgar just take it to another level. I see that happening to GSP if he gets back in the octagon against Johnny Hendricks.
Yeah, I wouldn't say it was a robbery. I think it all comes down to how you scored that first round. I think a case could be made for either one. I, like you guys, I thought Hendricks won. But, you know, I'm not outraged that GSP was able to retain. The crazy thing to me, though, in this whole thing is, you know, whether or not he was planning to retire before the fight, I think it's to a point now where he can't. You know, he cannot retire now. Even if that was his intention going into the fight, if he retires now, he goes out looking like a punk. And that's no way for, you know, one of the greatest fighters in the history of UFC to go out, in my opinion.
I don't think that matters as much to GSP, especially not to slight on the French or the French Canadians. They just have a different mindset and different values. And being a man,
I think you just did.
Yeah, being masculine and whatnot isn't really at the top of a list of GSP. And the way I see him come up, I don't think he's one of those beat your chest alpha males. And I'm not saying that as an affront to him. I'm saying that as somebody who I think he has a lot of class and grace and dignity. And he just doesn't come off like somebody who wants to prove everybody wrong. He's just very comfortable in his own skin.
Yeah, I mean, he can walk away. He's done, even if you take away this fight, he's done more than enough defending the title to prove himself in that division, in the welterweight division. So there's no one who would, well, besides you, Nate, that would question GSP if he did decide to walk away, because he has the resume to back up his accomplishments.
And I'm not saying it would take away from his accomplishments. I'm just saying it's a bad way to go out for a legend.
It is, and I would question GSP, especially given the fact that this was so close in a fight that he probably lost. I want to see what happens. It's all about that validation. This is the type of thing that rematches are made of. So I definitely want to see that rematch, and there will be unfinished business if he is to go on out on this note.
But I mean, what would coming back and losing prove? I mean, if you're going to go out, why not go out on top? Yeah, he might have lost, but yeah, he's retiring with the belt.
And on paper, sounds great. But when you're telling the tale of GSP, again, that fifth round is what decided that fight. So in essence, in the bigger picture, how he goes out, the fifth round of his career, is going to be the fight that he should have lost to Johnny Hendricks.
And the thing is, you mentioned Dana White. Like, Dana didn't help his boy at all. You know, Dana White has the power to tamp this down or, you know, smooth things out in terms of how the fans perceive this fight and how the fans perceived GSP after this fight. But Dana instead, you know, doing what Dana does, you know, Dana's fanning the flames.
And I think that's a very savvy business move on Dana White, who, I mean, this had been going on all weekend, is GSP just hadn't been right mentally. So I think Dana White had a feeling that this might be GSP's last fight, win or lose. So as close as it was, he wants to go out and help stir those headlines that GSP lost his fight, so that GSP would have a reason and have cause to come back, and you have a storyline leading into the rematch.
Yeah, I don't have a problem with what Dana White did. Because if Dana White were to say, you know, if you were to side with GSP, then you have people who would say, oh, well, Dana White's in, you know, they're in the pocket of each other. The man was speaking from the heart, and I got to respect that. I think that's why I love Dana White so much, and a lot of people respect him, is because he does speak from the heart. He's not on one side or another when it comes to a fighter. I mean, you did what you did with Dana White.
Yeah, I agree. Like, for the most part, like, I like Dana, except for that stuff with John Jones. But other than that, you know, I think Dana is probably, you know, I looked at that with the UFC documentary. Mm-hmm. 20 years of the UFC, and you know, for all of the financial and business savvy that the Fertittas brought to the table, this company would not be where it is without Dana White, because you know, he was kind of the catalyst, you know, not from a financial standpoint, but from the spirit and the imaging and the molding of that image of the UFC. That's all Dana. So speaking of images, you know, we got to go out with a good story, a feel good story, and if you hadn't bought your tickets to Coachella yet, you might want to go out and get them right now, because one of the greatest and most influential rap groups in the history of hip hop is quote unquote reforming, even though they would probably tell you they never broke up, and somebody else would probably tell you that they certainly never broke up. We'll get into that a little bit later, but Outkast is back, everybody, and you know, contrary to GSP, who might be bowing out, Andre 3000 and Big Boy are back, and they're going to be headlining Coachella.
Well, we think they're back. We don't really know for sure yet, because we're going off the Rolling Stone story, or Billboard, I'm sorry. Billboard is claiming they're
doing... We got a reputable source. Sleepy Brown said they're going to be back.
I don't trust anyone named Sleepy. So
if you can't trust Sleepy Brown's Instagram, who can you trust in this new media age, Marcus?
I can trust the Coachella press release when they put that out. That's who I trust. So supposedly they're breaking up. They're not breaking up. They're returning after their just now going on 8-year hiatus to headline Coachella next year out here in California. And it's about time. I mean, I think we're all expecting this at some point, and it sounds like they will be doing more than one show. This won't be just a one-time deal. They plan on doing concerts throughout next year, which would be good for people who don't want to spend the money and or be surrounded by junkies at Coachella. You can go out and actually see them at a arena. So this is good. This is good news.
This is very good, and you're talking about images, Nate. I really think that they missed the boat on the social media era, because they got out and they had no signs of slowing down. They went out really on top. I know they probably never broke up, but when they went away for 7-8 years, then came this Facebook Twitter revolution that I think they would have thrived in, given the crazy images and innovative ideas that they always had for their music videos. And I just think that they could have spoken to a new generation, and they would have been right up there as one of the top bands or top musical acts, hip-hop groups, that could really captivate it on this social media revolution. And the thing about Andre 3000 is Big Boy is a great MC. I think he's very good. But Andre 3000 had, like, top 10 potential if he would have gone into a solo career. But he comes out with, like, one verse every 2 years, and it's, like, the illest verse of the year. And then he goes away and does whatever he does for a couple of years. So I really think that them coming back, I don't know how long it's going to be. It's probably going to be a one-off. It's going to be good music.
You just talking about the lyricism. I think other than Wu-Tang, and Wu-Tang had the advantage because they had so many members, but I think we've never seen a group with two lyricists, two MCs that could arguably make the case that they're, you know, top 15, top 20 in the game, you know, and with Andre 3000, I think individually, I will say it, Marcus. I think individually,
I'll give you Andre. I don't know about Big Boy being top 15, but he's up there.
Big, you know what I'm saying? I will go on record as saying Big Boy, when Outkast was at their peak, you could have made the argument that Big Boy individually was a top 20 MC. Not of all time, but, you know, currently.
No, I was just going to say Eric B and Rakim in terms of hip-hop duos who are...
Oh, just duos.
I'm talking about the lyricist aspect. He was saying how... We haven't seen anyone like that. I mean, I think we have, but no one recently, no.
Yeah, and I think that the two of them, they were kind of always before their time, even when they were 20 years ago, when they were doing the Southern Playalistic Cadillac music, which the cool thing about Coachella is it's going to be on the 20th anniversary of that record dropping. Even when they were doing kind of the regular ghetto kind of thug music, it was their version of the ghetto thug music. It was their version of, you know, that kind of hood rap. And then they just took it from there and took it to a whole other level. And that's why the next part of the story, Alfred, that's why that makes me so sad, because thankfully there have been some reports out now that dispute this. But one of the craziest stories from last week involved Big Boi and his wife, or I guess now ex-wife. And breakups get dirty, breakups get messy, breakups get, people say things that they don't often mean because they're trying to hurt somebody. And she didn't produce any pictures, didn't produce any evidence, but she took to social media to say, the whole world wondering where Andre 3000 been. Just check Big Boi phone. He right there, naked. Yeah.
I'm not touching this story.
Shalita saying that nude photos of Andre 3000 was on her husband's cell phone. Alfred Tate.
They travel together, and all this is alleged. We don't know anything, but they travel together, and they're in locker rooms, and they get changed together. So maybe he just happened to have a picture while Andre was changing. There are perfectly fine explanations for this. And you're not famous in this world until there's a gay rumor about you. Try Googling anybody who's famous, any male who's famous. Put his name in Google. Google will try to finish the sentence for you by putting gay at the end. So, and if it's gay at the end, the person is very famous. So this is just, that's all that is to me. And a vindictive woman, hell hath no fury like a woman scorned. So I don't know. I'm not going to believe this.
Again, Antoine, Big Boi, Patton, she's trying to say that he had the pictures of his homeboy on the phone. I don't believe it. And even if Andre 3000 happened to be what she claimed, or Big Boi happened to be what she claimed, that wouldn't change my appreciation for their music, not one bit.
It would be an explanation as to why they were so good together.
and here's the crazy thing. Like, people are always talking about, when are we going to have the gay rapper that everybody embraces? And people could talk about Frank Ocean, but I don't think, that he kind of hedged his bets on what he is, what he was, what he does. But I think it would take a group or an individual at the level of, a Big Boi, Andre 3000, to get that mainstream acceptance in terms of inside the rap community, Marcus. Like, you can't be a scrub and be a gay rapper. Like, you got to be like Jackie Robinson almost. You can't be a bad black player. You got to be the best black player in order to overcome all the prejudice. And you can't just be an average MC if you're gay. You got to be the greatest gay MC that ever lived in order to overcome that prejudice.
No, they would still get the same backlash as you would expect. People would stop listening. People would stop listening to Outkast. Come on. Let's be real.
Okay, and I could see Marcus's point there, but Nate, you say it have to be one of the greatest gay MCs. Well, there wouldn't be much competition there.
You have to be the greatest MC ever.
Yeah, exactly. You have to be one of the greatest of all time, because you look at a guy like Eminem, who's white, and he had that Vanilla Ice taint. So Eminem, you could put him up right there with Tupac and Biggie in the top five. I don't care what anybody says. This guy, if you listen to his new album, if you listen to any of his album, this guy can just spit. He is a lyricist to the core. And he had to do it by ciphering. He had to do it in MC competitions. He had to prove himself on so many different levels of hip-hop acceptance. When he won a Grammy for Album of the Year, he went out there and he just shouted out a bunch of hip-hop acts that influenced him. And so you have to really, really pay your dues and then become one of the best of all time if you want that label to be shed. And I think if it comes to a gay rapper, in order to be bulletproof against that type of backlash that they would receive, they would just have to be ill to the core.
You don't think Outkast could come out tomorrow and say they were gay without receiving a backlash?
Oh, there's no shot. No shot. Plus, what have you done for me lately? When has Outkast been dropping music the last 7 years? So,
yeah.
No, this is.
See, I think that would help them in a sense because they've already got their crown. They've already, you know.
Okay, but if they stretch,
they're one of the greatest hip hop groups of all time. They crossed over to the mainstream, but they still didn't lose their street appeal. I think, you know, they don't have anything left to prove in terms of musically.
Well,
I think they could go out and say, "Hey, we're gay."
If two dope boys
in a Cadillac.
If they put out another album, if they went on tour, you would see the backlash to it. If they were to just say, "Hey, we're gay and that's it, we're done rapping," that's one thing. But if they were trying to continue their career, then yeah, you would see the result.
I think the only thing that would save them is that they wouldn't be as popular as they once were. The backlash would come if they were on top of the world and say they were gay, and then I think they'd go away at that point. But not only are they not as popular, so I don't think the backlash would be as strong. We are living in a society in transition toward accepting gay rappers, gay people, gay professional wrestlers. I remember when Darren Young came out and people looked at the culture of WWE and said, this is gonna be one of the biggest stories of the year. And him being gay is this, that, and the other. And really, it's been an afterthought. Nobody really cares that he's gay. People even forgot. So I really do think that even in hip-hop, which is as homophobic as it gets, I don't think there would be that much of a backlash as there would be if they were on top of the world maybe 5-6 years ago.
See, now I really want Outkast to come out and be gay just so I could be right. And it's a shame. I want Andre and Big Boy to reveal that they've been lovers all this time so I can be right and everybody, like, they'll still have a platinum record.
You really think that people would embrace that?
I think they would.
Wait,
let
me clarify. You really think the black community would embrace that? I should clarify myself.
Right. Because I was going to say, like, mainstream white America, like, they're already all in on Outkast. Like, Outkast already, you know, got their mainstream cred a long time ago. But I think in terms of the black community, I think it would take somebody like that. Like, you can't be a new guy to come out and be, you could be the illest new guy in the world, but if you're gay and you don't have any credentials, any reputation, I think will be much harder than for an Outkast because everybody's got, you know, a gay uncle or a gay aunt or something like that, you know, in the family. And it's like, okay, respect given. I think because Big Boy and Andre have been out since the mid-90s, you know, since, what was it, 94, 95, that they've got enough equity built up within the black community that this wouldn't hurt them as much as, say, if Kendrick Lamar came out and said, "Hey, I'm gay, everybody." I think it would be much easier for Outkast than it would be for Kendrick Lamar.
Well, it's easier because they're not rapping. What have they been doing? I mean, if they try to put out another album, yeah, I just don't see it. Come on. We're talking about, you know, we talked about Terry Rhodes. This guy is still unsigned. There's still those rumors that hang over his head. You know, we've seen with the Collins twin. Still unsigned, despite teams out in NBA who desperately need big men. So I just don't, I don't buy it. I think we are giving the black community too much credit when it comes to embracing gay culture and gay people in general.
Right, and again, this really wouldn't be a black community thing if it was Outkast. And I don't even think it would be as much with Kendrick Lamar. It would be more so with him because his type of hip-hop is that grimy type MC hip-hop that, even though he's grown up, he appeals more to those hardcore fans, and he's not really a white America-friendly rapper. I think if it is somebody who's going to come out and receive support, it would have to be a mainstream act like Outkast, because then, universally, they would appeal to more demographics.
Plus, you got to factor in, okay, say if they come out, does that mean they would be gay lovers? I just think there's so many dynamics that it just, right, there's no way it, that this would be cool.
In my hypothetical Outkast gay scenario, it's not Andre's gay or Big Boy's gay. It's that they both gay and they both gay together. That's my hypothetical Outkast gay scenario.
Is this scenario or fantasy? Because you got this stuff mapped out.
He's thought about this before.
No, man, that's elaborate. Anything wrong with that?
I've never thought about this.
Lyrics for Obama. Don't pull the thing out unless you ready to bang. Don't even bang unless you trying to hit something.
I'm sorry, Miss Jackson.
Never meant to make your daughter cry, but I'm in love with this rapping guy. Got to read between the lines, brothers. didn't think an hour ago this is where we're going to end the show on. Outcast as gay lovers. This is a fascinating conversation, though, in all seriousness. I think that it would be, Outcast would be an interesting case study in terms of what would the black community, because like you said, Marcus, and it's a good point, that the black community at large has been rather reticent to accept openly gay celebrities. Like, they ain't got no problem with people that may or may not be quote-unquote, a little bit funny, but openly and proudly gay celebrities, the black community has been kind of slow to embrace. So it'll be interesting to see how they would get treated if Andre and Big Boy came out as gay. That would be very fascinating, in my opinion.
Oh, I'm done. I'm done with this story. This is just getting so much for having them on the show. We can erase Outkast from the wish list.
This is all allegedly. I think it would be fascinating too. Just for the record, I really hope they would be accepted, but I can't make any guarantees.
I would accept it. I would buy your gay records. I would.
Why are the gay records, though? This is the problem I'm talking about. The fact that you say I would buy their gay records just tells me that we're not ready to embrace this in hip hop.
I'm ready to buy the Love Below Part 2.
All right.
When
Vlad is calling you next week, I'm staying out of this one because this is all on you.
Oh, you just gonna leave me out on an island on that?
Yep.
One? Maybe you should be the manager, Nate, because you got some pretty innovative ideas here.
Hey, it's all about moving into the future. This is a brave new world.
Love Below Part 2.
Yeah, the Love Below Part 2. Yes. So I think that's where we're gonna end it this week. Who knew an hour and a half ago that we were gonna end up at this point, but that's how it goes. You never know what we're going to talk about here on the Kings of Sport. yeah, we'll look forward to Coachella. And hopefully Sleepy Brown was right, and we will get some more Outkast music in the future. Marcus Vandenberg, if you've recovered, can you let the people know where they can follow you, where they can find your work, and where Glad can contact you if they need a statement?
Me and Vlad are in good terms. I've written stuff in the past that they have read and have hit me up about and co-signed. So me and Vlad are good. It's you that they need to come after and have a talk with. You can find me on Twitter at Marco Will, MarcoWill.
Big Nasty.
Glad to hear that, Marcus. Find me on Twitter at This Is Nasty. Go to Bleacher Report, read the articles, watch the videos. Thank you for the congratulatory praise on the success, quote unquote, of my second show. But it's not my second show, it's your show.
And you can follow me at N8, MOZAIK, Nate Mosaic on Twitter. Follow all of us at Cospod, KOS_POD on Twitter, Facebook.com/ The Kings of Sport. Hit us up on iTunes, Stitcher, podcastland.com. Vote for us, podcast of the month in November. Got a week or so left. Thanksgiving coming up. I got some playoff games if you're interested in watching my playoff games on nnpstv.com. I did a game Saturday where I did commentary solo for 3.5 hours. And that's probably why we went to the Outcast. We went that direction because my brain is just fried from 6 hours of high school football over the past couple of days.
Doing your best Joey Styles impression, huh?
Yeah, I was gonna say I wasn't great because it's the first time I've done play by play in over a decade. But I'm somewhere in between Mike Tenay and Joey Styles. So
over the middle touchdown! Oh my god!
Yeah. By the second half, I was just making stuff up. I was just like I was saying stuff to entertain myself. I'm like, oh, it's a touchdown. He started from the bottom. Now he's here. No new niggas, bro. Nah, I didn't say that because I'd have been fired. I thought it. Next week we'll be back, maybe. Are we going to do a show next week?
Yeah.
Okay. Because I didn't know Thanksgiving if you guys had plans or you was going to be out of town or whatnot.
We've already cheated them out of 1 week, so I don't want to cheat the listeners out of a second week this month.
That's good. That's why we got you here, Marcus, because you keep us straight, keep us on the right path, and keep us dedicated and focused. Plus, you keep Glad off our backs.
And I hit the record button.
And he hits the record button.
He keeps crack off the show. This is a crack-free show.
It's a crack-free show.
If I remember.
All right. So shout out to Rob Ford. So that's going to do it for this week. We'll be back next week with a big show for Thanksgiving week. And that's going to do it. So for Big Nasty Africana, for Marcus Vandenberg, I am the Godfather, Nate Milton, and you've been down with the Kings.
Well, that's all for this week's edition of the Kings of Sport. Be sure to come back next week for an all-new episode. You can leave feedback for the show on Twitter at KOS_POD or via Gmail at thekingsofsport@gmail.com. Don't forget to like and rate us on iTunes and tell a friend. The Kings of Sport is a production of the Mosaic Podcast Network.
Whether you like it or not, he's back. D-A-double-D-Y, that's X. Sharp as a tack, like I just left.